Hello and welcome to the Engagement Coach Podcast.
Welcome to the Engagement Coach Podcast with your host, Amrit Sander. So this is part two of my discussion with Scott Jarvis. Scott, he brings with him a wealth of experience, occupational psychologist background, but he's worked in sectors as diverse as pharma, retail, construction, banking, and he's held roles such as head of HR and talent, head of change, talent development. So he brings with him wealth of experience. And last week we talked about some of the value or the struggle that both employee engagement and learning and development or talent development functions can have in demonstrating the value they can add and struggling to get traction within their own organizations. And we also talked about organizations that try and demonstrate an ROI and with the vast amount of variables there are in the work we do, how difficult that becomes. So this week, we want to carry on the conversation with Scott. He's agreed to come back and get involved in a deeper sort of discussion on some of these other aspects. So just carrying on the discussion from last week, you know, in the past, we would have been creating organizational strategies developed by the few, the boardroom, and that being cascaded down to the organization to say, here's the sense of direction or the direction of travel, and here's what everybody's going to subscribe to, here's what we're going to deliver. And that would be then broken down into goals, objectives by team and function. One of the things we've realized now, though, is that no one's got a clue about what the future is going to bring. So anybody who comes up with a strategy, it's just finger in the air. We're guessing in terms of what we think we might need to do, or worst case scenarios, best case scenarios. You know, the experts can't agree what the future is going to bring. I'm listening into some of the medical webinars just to keep my finger on the pulse of what's going on. And one thing is for certain, no one's got a clue of what the future is going to bring. So in this current climate, in the absence of any information, and considering the typical way that we've done things in the past, where the board would get the strategy together and cascade this down, what do you suggest organizations should be doing in terms of how we move forward in the current climate to make the best of both tomorrow, next year, and the future?
Sorry, I was just smiling as I was listening to you talk about looking at different medical reports and what have you. I've not forgotten your past as a pharmacist. So you must be quite amused at all of the armchair epidemiologists that have emerged over the course of the last few months. I think I must admit I've had my moments where I thought I was one as well.
You know, my kids are probably the worst.
You know, I think, you know, what COVID has really thrown into sharp relief is a trend that I think that was already emerging over quite a long period of time, which is that there are limits to the efficacy of old-fashioned, command and control strategy and planning approaches. And obviously, some organisations have gone further than others in sort of devolving those sorts of decision-making processes. I don't actually think strategy and planning is dead. Just because I think that in any organization there are too many vested interests both inside and outside of the organization in making sure that there appears to be something resembling a plan. So, you know, private organizations are accountable to their shareholders, public organizations are accountable to the taxpayer. I think there's always going to be a requirement to have something that states, well, where are we trying to go as an enterprise, even if it's only at the uppermost level. But then I suppose the question then becomes, well, beyond that, how much more planning is done for individual business units and teams and what have you? And I think that that's where you'll start to see a bit of a shift where decision making necessarily will have to become more devolved. You know, we'll have to accept that different departments and teams, and if you're working in a regional business, whether that's, you know, regional UK or regional globally, you know, we're all, or each of those different regions are going to be facing different sets of circumstances, and therefore we'll have to enact different strategies and plans according to those circumstances. And that's where you need leaders at different levels to be able to have the freedom, dare I use the word empowerment, to be able to decide what's right, and to be able to do so in a pretty agile way, because as we've learned, circumstances can change rather quickly. You know, I know that there would be immunologists and experts out there that would say it's only a matter of when, not if, the next pandemic will be coming. But I doubt many people 6 months ago were thinking that we were going to be facing the crisis that we're facing now. And so a couple of things come to mind for me. One is I think that the business of strategizing and planning could do well to be a more participative process. And I'm going to cite some more stuff that is not new. It's decades old. There are methods and techniques that I think have historically largely been more popular in North America than they have over in Europe. Search conferences, open space technology, workout. There are dozens of them. They're all techniques for bringing together large groups of people, often, in total representative of the organization as a system, if you like, and often involving a real cross-section of people. So it's not necessarily, the sort of leadership community, if you like. And those techniques, depending on which one you choose, well, in the first instance, depending on what you want it to achieve, the different techniques can be used to bring those people together to develop vision, to envision a future. They can be used to develop strategy. They can be used to figure out how do we work, implications for organization design, and how do we work across boundaries, across departments, and they can also be used for then figuring out, okay, well, if this is where we're going and this is how the work's going to get done, what does it actually mean in terms of capability? What infrastructure do we need? What capabilities do we need? Which is obviously, particularly interesting for folks like you and I. And I think that those techniques are really useful for a handful of reasons. One is we all know that involvement leads to commitment. So I think that they're really, really powerful for engagement. People find it very hard to resist things that they actually had a hand in creating or designing, if you see what I'm saying. But I also think that there's another really, really powerful, well, the second byproduct is you're actually making better use of the knowledge in the organization. So, it's coming back to your point, I think, which is that, we've got to stop looking to the few leaders in the organization to have all of the answers. The world is much too fast moving and complex for that. And any leader worth their salt would acknowledge that they don't have all of the answers, and there are plenty of subject matter experts around the organization that, depending on your question, will be better placed than they are to answer it. And then the third thing is, by dint of everything that I've just said, it means that because those people have been involved in the whole business of visioning, strategizing, designing the organization, figuring out what capabilities are necessary, that they've got more insight with which to be able to make decisions and prioritize and reprioritize as and when circumstances change, if that makes sense. So I think that those techniques, I'm not sure that everyone is going to jump on that straight away, but I do think that those techniques are particularly powerful in times like these. And that's where talent and learning teams have got a big part to play, because they do require these interventions do require some very, very careful design. And moreover, they need to be really expertly facilitated, because inevitably there will be conflict. There will be differing views about how the world works and what's important, and there'll be trade-offs to be made. And they do require, the capture and sense making of information, so that when all of this dialogue has been had and all of the drawings have been done on the flip charts or the brown paper and the post-it notes have come down and all the rest of it, there's something that gets played back that everyone who participated in recognizes and can say, yeah, that kind of represents my understanding of all that was talked about and agreed over the last 2 to 3 days. Sometimes these things necessarily have to go on for a few days because there's so much ground to cover. So that's one thing that comes to mind. And then I suppose at a more micro, so if that's the macro level stuff, I suppose at a more micro level, I think that there are going to be really important, the line manager, if they were not center stage already, I think they're going to be increasingly so in the new era, because they are going to need to be skilled and confident in being able to make local decisions and reprioritize, and in doing all of that, you know, manage their teams really, really effectively, both in terms of task and making sure that, you know, people know what's expected of them, and they know, and crucially they understand why, because we all know that you know, one of the roles of a good line manager is infusing work with purpose, you know, rather than just listing out tasks. But also, you know, understanding, well, what do people need in order to you know, meet those tasks, and that in itself is, you know, is a real skill. The business of being able to insightfully ask your team members the right questions about what resources do they need, what capabilities do they need to have invested in, being able to coach and give good feedback. These, you know, if they weren't important already, I think they're going to become even more important in the future for line managers to be able to make sure that not only can they make the right decisions at a more local level, you know, in the absence of detailed strategy that gives them line by line instructions, but also they're able to make sure that what their teams need in order to meet those plans can be catered for. And I think a real trick to pull off there, coming back to again, what's the role of talent and learning and all of that. I think one, investing in those skills in the first place is obviously something that we should take accountability for, but there's also something to be said for how do you capture the output of those conversations in some meaningful way, and that's kind of twofold, because some of the product of those conversations about what capabilities do you need to have invested in can be responded to locally by the line manager. So if you think about the old 70-20-10 model, you know, although I know that we could all argue the toss about its rectitude, if you can at least subscribe to the idea that only a proportion of adult learning requirements can be satisfied by classic means like courses, programs, e-learning, books, whatever. If we can all sign up to the idea that actually an awful lot of how we learn and how we progress and change and grow comes down to relationships and experiences, then that's not easily coordinated by any central talent and learning team. You know, we can provide resources and infrastructure, but in the end, it comes down to line managers being able to get creative in thinking about, well, how can I give someone access to relationships? How can I give someone maybe some stretch in their role, or maybe something a little bit more definite, like a project, a rotation, a secondment, that helps them to, you know, develop those capabilities that we've agreed are important for them to acquire. So I think it's a real balancing act between aggregating up needs and then making sure that your learning agenda responds to them at the sort of aggregate level, but at the same time making sure that line managers don't assume that all learning activity is just going to be generated by a department that sits within HR.
There's a number of things that you mentioned there that really resonate. I mean, one of my frustrations with the education system, I think people are doing an amazing job in the education system trying to teach the next generation skills and educate them in a way that we're going to need for the future. But I think there's one big flaw, which is the lack of critical thinking, developing skills that really help people with critical thinking. And if you think, you know, if we could do that in organizations where leaders and managers at a local level are able to take into account information that they have and that incorporate some of the soft skills to be able to lead their team and involve them. And it's going back to my pharmacy days, you know, I used to use the analogy of a cell, that the cell with more receptors around it will adapt and respond to its environment far quicker than those with very few. And so the more people we get involved, the more data we use in terms of information, the more then we can act and respond accordingly. So yeah, that just makes sense. And that feeds nicely into this whole concept of diversity and inclusion. You know, the more we bring people in and let them do things their way, I mean, I'm sure many of us get accused of dictating how things should be done. I know my team will sometimes say to me, "You've always got an opinion." I have. If you ask me, I'll tell you. Otherwise, I'm really happy for you to get on with it. And I think, you know, we want to create an environment where rather than being dictated to, rather than being told to, I mean, certainly now we are in uncharted waters. What we want to now do is have people bring their talent to the table where they can do things their way. It may not be how we choose or how we would have done it. but we want to make sure that they're bringing what they're so good at to the table. And, you know, so many times we've been surprised at what people have done. And I think it's a really interesting point, you know, this cognitive diversity, allowing people to bring their talent to the table. Scott, I've seen, I mean, you and I will have seen this across our careers, talented people leaving organizations who weren't thought of as being talented and then going on to be brilliant elsewhere. And it's just a shame that we then lose that skill.
I couldn't agree with you more. And it's interesting, isn't it? And what you're talking about here is a transferable skill. It's like learning how to learn. And I think that learning practitioners can actually help with that stuff. I've seen it, I've done it myself, and I've seen it done very well elsewhere. And to do otherwise, you know, to try it, I think for central learning and talent teams to try too hard to cater for each and every single learning requirement, actually, perhaps unwittingly, can have a quite unhelpful consequence, because what you generate is passivity. You know, you're almost discouraging, unintentionally, people to think for themselves and show a little bit of agency in thinking about, well, okay, how can I begin to close gaps in my own knowledge and capability and do so for my team? I don't want to name drop, but I'm going to do it just this once. The now CEO of Sanofi, who have been in the news quite a bit for obvious reasons over the last few weeks, a chap called Paul Hudson, and I worked with him when I was at AstraZeneca, and he used to talk about this all the time. He used to talk about acquired incompetence, and this was kind of what he was getting at. He was saying, you know, if you try too hard to tell people all of the time what's to be done and what they need to learn, not only are you creating a rod for your own back because it's all on you, but you're actually doing them a real disservice because you're actually discouraging them from thinking for themselves. And I think that was really insightful stuff that's really stayed with me for nearly 15 years now. So I think that, you know, looking ahead, the role of learning and talent development teams, you know, probably needs to shift onto thinking about developing those meta capabilities rather than, you know, the sort of individual detailed bits and pieces of how do you go about managing a team, managing performance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Because it doesn't do managers or individuals a service.
What can organizations do? This talent, how can we start to take stock of the skills that people have across our organizations now rather than lose them to other organizations where they go on and develop them or express them? How can we take stock of that across an organization to really make sure that the organization gets the best of its people?
I think that that's a really important observation. And I think that there are a few culprits. There's a few reasons why that happens in organizations. I think one is line managers often hire for the immediate needs of the role that they're hiring for. And I think that what can sometimes come with that is people get pigeonholed, for want of a better word, because they're seen through the lens of what that role is and what it demands and what capabilities and experience come with it. And we often sort of forget to ask, you know, what are the things that you like to do and have done and aspire to do that are kind of above and beyond what this job description says? I understand why line managers might not necessarily go there because they've got an immediate requirement and they're under a lot of time pressure and what have you. And so I think that that's where learning and talent professionals have got a part to play in making sure that when we're designing things like capability frameworks and selection and assessment methodologies, that there's some range in there, and we're thinking, you know, we're encouraging line managers to sort of explore what an individual might be bringing to the organization that's above and beyond the immediate requirements of the job description in hand. I think that and allied to that, it's not just about hiring. I think it's also about what sort of conversations we encourage line managers and employees to have in the normal scheme of things vis-a-vis performance management. I think there's, you know, inevitably there's a little bit too much focus, even now, I'm talking in general terms, of course, again, there's a little bit too much tendency to focus on task and to not use performance management conversations as an opportunity to explore development and aspirations and capabilities. I think sadly there's still a little bit of an afterthought. And again, you know, the question I have to ask then is, well, what's our part to play in that as talent and learning practitioners? And I think some of that's about, well, how do you go about designing the talent, the performance and talent process? What sort of questions are you prompting managers to ask? And how do you give them the skill? Because it's not easy for everyone. How do you give them the skill in being able to have a dialogue with someone that meaningfully starts to explore, well, what are your aspirations and what have you done? What do I not know about you that you know might be of value to the organization? I think there's also something which is a sort of minor but important point. If I put my talent and succession hat on, there is often a tendency for people to cosset their resources, particularly their most capable ones. And so what comes with that, sorry, by cosset resources, I mean, you know, they're less inclined to magnanimously hand them over to other teams and other managers. I think that what comes with that is people can get hemmed in. And I've lost count now of the amount of times that I've heard people say, it's easier to find a job outside of this organization than it is within it, because the whole business of signaling your interest in working in a different team is, you know, career suicide, or it's at least in some way political. So we need to find a way around that. We need to find a way of rewarding or encouraging managers to, you know, see talent as a sort of organizational asset rather than a local asset, if that makes sense. And that's not easy to do.
Just on that, Scott, I think there's a lot to do with some of the labels that we assign people. And by labels, I mean some of the job titles. We limit them to the job title and we see them for the job title that they've been assigned, as opposed to what they could be. And that ends up limiting their talent of what they can express, irrespective of what they've actually got you know, about them in terms of what they could offer. We end up only seeing them for their job title and the label that we've assigned, as opposed to the potential that they've got to demonstrate. And that doesn't help at all at times, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's absolutely right. I think that happens often. And I've had my own personal experience of that. And I think the other thing that we've got to think about is, well, let's say you do have a very clear and broad articulation of what, you know, what your desired capabilities are, and you have got skilled and willing line managers that can have really good conversations with their people, that teases out all sorts of interesting and useful information about people's experiences and aspirations and skills and what have you. What do you do with that data? And I think that that's a really big challenge, because you know, the software is out there. You know, most ERP systems or learning management systems, or, you know, sort of bolt-on talent management software enables you to capture that information. It requires a bit of config. You know, you've got to know what questions you want to ask people and what sort of data you want to capture. But it can be done. And I don't think that the system or the process is actually the challenge. Although that's normally where most of the effort gets spent, because that's the easy stuff, right? You know, the real trick is actually making sure that line managers have the time and skill to have these conversations with their people, which is really difficult, because oftentimes it's not immediately obvious to them what the payback is. You know, why would I spend time surfacing information that benefits the organization but might ultimately disbenefit me, because it might mean that this individual, you know, gets plucked away because it turns out that they've actually got all sorts of nascent skills and ambitions that are going to mean that they're, you know, they've got perhaps an even more useful and edifying role to play in another part of the organization. And that's when I would come back to, well, some of that's a cultural thing where you've got to think about, well, how do you select and develop leaders so that they do think that these things are important and think beyond their own immediate needs? Some of it I do think is about reward with a little R. So I don't mean, you know, you get paid a bounty for jettisoning someone into another part of the organization. But, you know, I've seen on and off, certainly for more senior leaders, part of a central part of their, you know, their sort of annual performance appraisal criteria, if you like, is about developing talent and succession. And that doesn't necessarily mean to themselves or their own department. It's for the enterprise at large. You know, they will be recognized and rewarded for developing people that then go on to play an even more important role, dare I say it, a bigger role elsewhere in the organization. I think, you know, again, I don't want to overuse the word enlightened, but I have noticed organizations down the years that are a little bit more enlightened do that and do it really well, and it works because it then moves you away from this business of people leaving the organization, because it so happens to be it's easier for them to fulfill their ambitions outside than it is inside, which is a tragedy.
I completely agree with you, and I think going forward there's a real opportunity now to, in the current way of working, that we have a chance to, I think there's a leveling where we've reset the clock, if you like, and we have a chance to see people for what they can truly demonstrate, their potential as opposed to their job title and what we think they've been limited to. Scott, you've had an amazing career. You've worked in such diverse sectors. You've had some great insights. What would you say has been your own biggest personal learning to date?
I think that my biggest learning to date would be, with my talent and learning hat on, I think it's making sure that your agenda remains relevant, which sounds like a bit of an obvious thing to say, but I think it is a bit easy for talent and learning teams to find that its agenda, its curriculum, if you like, can fall out of kilter with what the organization's priorities are. And that's super important because, you know, the credibility, the value of any talent and learning team has got to be judged by whether or not it's developing and delivering relevant content, it's fostering the right capabilities, it's cultivating the desired culture, it's supporting engagement, and it's developing a pipeline of future leaders. You know, it's trying to help future-proof the organization. All of those things are, you know, they give us our license to operate, I think. And I think that down the years, both as a generalist HR business partner and then as a specialist in talent, I've learned about the importance of that and how to go about achieving that has always been a bit of a challenge, because HR practitioners, for as long as I've been at work, have talked about being at the table, you know, and being close to the business's priorities and having a voice and all of that sort of thing. And of course, yes, that's very important, but of course the people that are at the table tend to be those that are in HRD, head of HR or HR business partnering role. So our job in talent and learning is sort of once removed, which means you have to be, a little bit more proactive, for want of a better word, in making sure that you are getting face time with business leaders and understanding, you know, what's on their minds and how does that shake out in terms of capability requirements, that you keep really close to subject matter experts around the organization. So I've always found it incredibly important to keep close to colleagues in functions like IT, finance and marketing to understand, well, you know, what's their part to play in the business and how do we support them, not just the profit and loss generating areas or the operational facing folks. And then of course working really closely and effectively with our colleagues in the generalist business partnering community, because they're the people that are walking around with the, you know, the people plans, and what we do needs to be derivative of that. It needs to directly feed into their priorities. So lots of stakeholder management, lots of different people across different disciplines and at different levels to operate with. And I think I've finessed that over the years. And then, of course, the other side of that is then making sure that as you're learning what priorities are and how they're shifting and changing, making sure that your team understand them if you have one, and that the agenda, you know, is adjusted accordingly, and that, you know, whatever needs to be done is enacted as quickly as possible, whether it's stopping activity, creating new programs, introducing new systems, developing capability frameworks, you name it. And I kind of get off on that anyway. I like change. I like to go reasonably quickly. So I like it when, you know, we're kept on our toes and we're close to what's important to the business and we're being seen to be responsive to it. So I think the main thing for me would be, you know, learning how to be that fulcrum, that partner to, quite a broad range of stakeholders and the work of the talent and learning team itself.
Well, Scott, it's going to be that approach and that mentality that's going to help us get through this. So people who love change and who are proactively willing to help an organization get through what we're going through, you know, I've said it before that the thinking that got us into this isn't going to be the thinking that gets us out. And it's going to have to be a different way of working, a different way of engaging, a different way of leading that's going to make sure we bring the best of an organization together using all the talents that helps us through this. Scott, thank you so much for sharing your vast experience, your insights with us. It's been fascinating. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks once again, Amrit. Like I said at the top of the session, privileged that you asked me. Thoroughly enjoyed sharing my insights. Hope it's been of use to those that listen, and look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. Thank you. So that's Scott Jarvis. Hopefully you found that really interesting. That's our guest for today. Join us again where we'll have more guests on the podcast. That's all from me for now. Amrit Sander from The Engagement Coach. I will see you soon. Take care.
The Engagement Coach Podcast.